crazy it seems to have a dream to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm Mark Dick, I'm your host, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and the people that work so hard to make the good stuff and share it with people in their community. I'm so glad that you're listening to the show today. We're kicking off season 5 of the podcast, which is very remarkable from my perspective, because I really didn't know when I started this if I would be able to keep on enticing people to come on the show, and would we have good things to talk about, and all of that, and it's really turning out well, I think. I hope you like it. I'm still getting good feedback, so thanks for that. Today on the show, we're kicking off season 5 with a bang, because Jeffrey Hamelman is on the show today. We had a really good chat about his career in baking, and as a book author, and as a teacher, and really as someone who has very quietly and very humbly led the whole North American bread thing over the last 20, 30 years. He's just really one of the giants of the bread scene, and I'm so thrilled that I had a chance to have a good chat with Jeffrey a couple of weeks back. And so we're going to share that with you coming up soon. But hey, Easter is coming up, and around these parts, that means a lot of special baking, like hot cross buns and Easter braids and that kind of thing. And I've got a hot cross bun story to share with you in a sec. But before I do that, I wanted to just give a shout out to Charlie Emmers. Hi, Charlie. And he wrote a very nice email after last week's show. And Charlie reminded me that it's not just Easter coming up. It's also Passover coming up. And there's a lot of traditional baking that goes along with Passover, especially like matzahs and the unleavened crackers. And, you know, I should have mentioned that. I'm a little cautious about even mentioning any kind of holidays these days, not from any sense of, political correctness or anything, but more because I don't want to leave anyone out. And unfortunately, where I live, there is, a synagogue and that, but I don't know really all that much about Jewish culture, other than what I see on TV or what I hear, that kind of thing, but certainly not the rhythms and the cycles of the year, and all the food that goes with that. Maybe that's something I should learn. I'd love to learn more about it. And in the same vein, I don't know the rhythms of the Muslim year or any other faith. I barely know the rhythms of the Christian year, because I'm not really a I don't really practice any religion, to be honest with you. So, what I do is try and support my customers however they would like. And so, which is going to bring me to the hot cross bun story in a sec. But not only that, all kinds of celebration breads. I am sort of this person that if somebody wants it, I will try and figure it out and try and make it for them. In fact, we had a Greek Orthodox church come. The priest came to see us when we had Orange Boot Bakery, and said, the ladies are getting older, and we always have this artos bread for certain ceremonies and certain events. I think it was like sort of All Saints Day in the Greek Orthodox faith. And so what they would do is, if it was like Lucia's, if it was St. Lucia's day, then Lucia was on the hook to bring the artos for the service, and then they would eat it afterwards. And the priest came and he said, nobody wants to make this anymore, so would you make it for us if we had a lady come and teach us? And I said, sure, I'll do this, which started a 5-year terror run on my part because I dreaded making our toast for these folks. Because when Maria came and gave me the instructions and helped make it, she was kind of vague, even though we were going really quick and taking good notes. And she left before, you know, I even baked off the bread. And so I never really did have this picture of what it should look like. But it was never right the whole time. And, you know, sometimes I would get politely told that it wasn't quite right. And sometimes it wasn't very polite at all. And then I finally said, okay, well, I think I've got this figured out and I'm just going to make it my own way. And then they could say, well, yes, it looks much, much better, but it doesn't taste right. And so I couldn't win with the Artos. But, you try and help out however you can. And you know, some folks would come in and say, hey, for Rosh Hashanah, can you make round challah? And I was like, of course, yes, I will. But I needed a reminder every year as to when it was, because the Jewish culture in Saskatchewan is here. But I wouldn't say it's prominent, I guess, is the thing, right? So the holidays and the traditions just aren't talked about. So thank you, Charlie, for reminding me that, hey, there are many cultures out there, and this time of year is special to a lot of different folks. And so whether you're celebrating Easter or Passover or other holidays this time of year, go for it. Whether you're just the kind of people that enjoy it through the food, that's awesome too. Whatever works. And certainly this show is about making all the good stuff for all the people, and I want to be as inclusive as possible. But anyways, on to my hot cross bun story, because it kind of ties into Jeffrey, who's going to be talking soon here. So when we opened Orange Boot Bakery, we opened in January, and that April was Easter coming up. And so people kept asking me, are you going to make hot cross buns for Easter? And that there is no part of my upbringing that included hot cross buns, like not at all. I have no idea, had no idea what they were, what they should taste like, what they should look like, what the big deal was. You know, it was something that you saw at the Safeway around that time of year, and that was about it. And so first thing I did is I went to Jeffrey Hamelman's book, the bread book, and lo and behold, he's got a hot cross bun recipe in there. And I'm like, holy Dinah, there is a lot of stuff in here, and I'm going to have to find candied peel and figure this out. And there's this crazy sponge at the start that I don't do with anything else, but what the heck, we're going to make it. And we're going to make hot cross buns for folks. And people went crazy for these things. I had no idea. The first hot cross bun I ever tasted in my life was the one that I made at Orange Boot Bakery. It was so weird. But they turned out, and people would come and buy like one bun and walk out to the car and then come back in and buy six or buy a dozen. It was the strangest thing. I'd never seen anything like it. And we were just starting, and we didn't know how much to make, and we didn't know really, we were still learning production schedules and all of that stuff. And it was just mayhem with these bloody hot cross buns. And to the point where we would take orders and, you know, bake buns for people. We were making them every day and a couple times a day. And people would come and we'd say, okay, no more orders because we've got to finish off for the day. You know, come back tomorrow. And then the next day we would make, you know, 20 dozen or 30 dozen of these things and then package them up in six packs. And, you know, hopefully that would be enough for people. And my son, Ben, who was probably only about 14 or 15 at the time, was working in the front, and he was just getting terrified by people coming in, all these people coming in looking for hot cross buns. And our order system was terrible. It was just this little notebook, and we never did know if we had enough to fill all the orders and how many we could sell. And we'd be in the back kind of counting how many buns we actually had and how many could go out in the counter for sale. And I remember there was that Saturday before Easter, and people were lined up out the door, and poor Ben, I never saw a look of fear in his face like that day where, you know, we were continually trying to supply people with hot cross buns, and he had no idea what he could tell people if we had any or not, or that. And it was absolute mayhem. And so we just kept making them every year. And every year we would make more, and every year that would just barely be enough. But we figured it out, and it's just been part of the baking tradition, even if it still isn't part of the eating tradition in my house. Like, there's nobody in our house that likes them, but we keep baking them anyways. And I kept the tradition going just this weekend. On Sunday, I made a single batch. Well, not a single batch. A single bake day's worth of hot cross buns. And just for the folks that come to the backyard that wanted them. And just baked all day. And that's all we made was hot cross buns. And then folks picked up. And I got a few emails that they're very happy and very glad they got them. So, you know, it's part of the joy of being a baker, I guess, is that you can make people happy even if it's not your tradition. And, you know, this was quite honestly a recipe from a book, but a darn fine recipe. And, you know, it makes me feel good to know that here's this thing that even if I don't like it, other people really do, and it made their day a little bit. So if you're in a place where you're making hot cross buns or Easter braids or matzah or any other traditional baked good for the holidays, I hope you're making a lot. I hope you're making the good stuff, and I hope you're making people happy. So there you go. And now on to the main part of the show, which is the chat that I had about 2 weeks ago with Jeffrey Hamelman. I don't want to set it up too much other than I was very nervous going into the call because it was like, oh my God, it's Jeffrey and I don't want to screw this up. But he has a way of just making you relaxed, and I think we had a really great chat. So I'm thrilled to share that with you now. Here we go. How's things in Vermont today?
Sunny, very sunny. Lovely. Mustery. It's early spring, so yeah. a lot of birds. And yeah, still having the wood stove at night, but it's a beautiful time of year. And you're in Saskatchewan?
I'm in Saskatchewan, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
What city?
Regina.
Uh-huh.
Regina. So if you know Tracy, she's in Saskatoon, which is the other big city. So mm-hmm. So I'm a two-hour drive south of Tracy's place.
I think I went through Regina one year.
You sure?
Many years ago, I hitched from Vancouver to Montreal.
Yep, because the Trans-Canada Highway goes right through our city, for sure. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So cool. No, that's awesome. I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to you a little more than, you know, a quick bite of lunch at Wheatstock or something like that. So
well, let's hope you feel that way in an hour.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I'm curious, I guess first off, when you were growing up, what was food like in your house there, like as a child?
Oh, my mother wasn't very motivated and didn't really exert herself much in the kitchen. So yeah. The only food that was memorable, other than food that was mediocre or less, would have been the food that my grandmother cooked, because she did still have that generational thing about cooking and keeping you full and feeding. So I'd show up at her house and, you know, the next thing I knew, there was a pint of strawberries with a pint of sour cream on top and half a pound of sugar on top of that. And that was just the start.
So, yeah.
But no, food entered me through my grandmother for sure.
So nice. Yeah. And whereabouts was that? Like, where did
that was outside New York City, where I did part of my upbringing, and outside Philadelphia, where I did the other part.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And so then how did getting into baking happen for you?
Well, how did getting into baking happen? I had quit college and I gravitated towards farming.
Right.
And I loved farming. I farmed with a bunch of old Polish guys and Irish guys in Western Massachusetts for a few years, and then rented some land with my girlfriend. And one of the old Polish guys gave me free use of his tractor all summer.
Wow.
So we were in the mid-70s trying to farm organically. The word wasn't quite in the dictionary yet, and we didn't know what we were doing other than loving the work. So I really did love the work, but we couldn't even pay the bills. And during that summer, I accidentally ran into a woman who had started a bakery. I guess this would have been 1974 when I met her. She was a German woman, and I was walking down a road I had been on 100 times, and all of a sudden I looked to my left, and there was this woman taking bread out of an oven. It's like, my gosh, wow, I never saw anybody taking bread out of an oven and right there before. So I just was kind of gawking, I guess. It was the era when I was making homemade bread that maybe or maybe not the goats would eat. I'm not sure. But it was pretty rough, put it that way. But she must have seen me staring, and she came over, and we talked for quite some time. And she, before I left, she said, I will get you a loaf of bread. And she went over to the rack, and she came back and gave me this horribly burned loaf of rye bread. She said, this is the best loaf of the day. And I said to myself, well, either she's going to pawn it off on me or throw it in the trash. And I didn't want to seem disrespectful. So I said, thank you. And I took it home. And well, then I guess I had one of those food moments. I ate it, and it was certainly unlike anything I'd ever eaten before. It was true bread. It was a sourdough rye bread, basically. Sure. Coming directly from her German traditions. And so gradually I got to know her a bit. And then when farming wasn't working out, my girlfriend and I got offered to move to an artist community in the Berkshire Mountains of Western Massachusetts to be maintenance staff. We knew the director, and we leaped at the offer because it was a steady paycheck. We got $20 a week plus room and board, and that seemed like good news. So I was there for a year. I knew I didn't want to be there longer than a year. So a couple months before knowing I was going to leave, I went back down to the valley and asked this woman, Susan, if she would hire me. And she was quite succinct. She said, no, you can't bake. You're an American.
Oh, wow.
And she meant it. And she was right, I suppose. I don't know. So every 2 or 3 weeks, I'd show up again and ask her the same thing. Would you hire me? No, you can't bake. You're an American. She said the same thing over and over. Except one time she didn't say that to me. What happened was I made a loaf of homemade bread, which I'm sure was pretty rough looking. And I knew where she lived. I showed up at her house. It was 8 o'clock one morning, and she answered the door in her bathrobe. And I said, Susan, I made you a loaf of bread. Would you hire me? And she didn't say her usual response. She simply slammed the door in my face. So I think it must have been 2 months. It felt like 2 years. But finally, one day I asked her again, would you hire me? I guess I didn't give up too easily. And somehow I must have wore out her pretty strong Teutonic resistance, because I could see sort of the light went out of her eyes and her shoulders kind of slumped. And she said, okay, I'll hire you, but you have to make the pretzels. I said, I'll do anything. So she hired me. And yeah, I had to make the pretzels. But within a week, it was like, oh, do you remember that challah that you made for me? We should make that on Fridays. And then she'd come to me with all these things that her bakers didn't want to make. Her pastry chef was a Parisian guy. He didn't want any of that German stuff. So I'm doing the Linzer Torte, and I'm doing the Schwarzwalder Kirsch Torte, and the Lebkuchen, and the Stollen. And her bread baker was a guy from Grenoble, and he worked nights. I would overlap with him for about an hour each morning. And so he did the bulk of the bread, but I would make pastries all day, and then 1 to 2 specialty breads every day. So Michelle, working at night, would make all the French bread and make the sourdough rye bread, the sourdough wheat bread, and another naturally leavened pan au levain style bread. And I would make a specialty bread, a different one every day. So within, you know, a month or two at the most of working there, Susan said, okay, now you will make the Dreistufen Sauerteigfuhrung every Thursday. So that's a natural 3-stage Detmolder style bread.
Right.
90% rye flour. And it's like, wow. So this was kind of how I grew up in the bakery, you know, was making these incredible classics from Germany and from France. And I didn't have a dime, obviously, so I couldn't have gone to school, and I wouldn't have learned a tenth as much if I'd gone to school. So I stayed 5 years for her, and that was a really good, it was a good, solid foundation. I learned a lot of really good values, and I learned great classics from baking and pastry from France and Germany. So I couldn't have asked for a better start. Yeah.
Holy Dinah, that's so, I guess, fortunate to even have that near you, especially at that time.
Well, her husband was a professor at Smith College. He was a musician. And he was part of a pretty well-known German string quartet, too. So Susan would be in Germany, traveling here and there. And once I'd only been baking for, oh, I don't know, probably 4 months when she told me that the best bread she had ever eaten was at this bakery in Heilbronn in southern Germany. And she wanted to send me there, which I went there for a summer. I had only been baking 9 months. And so I didn't extract as much as I could have or would have had I been baking for a few years. But I spent a good chunk of the summer in Heilbronn baking at this pretty big bakery. They had 12 steam-injected wood-burning ovens. They were building 6 more.
Wow. They
had a tunnel oven for part of their bread production. It was a combination of both very what nowadays is called artisan breads, but also industrial, like their line for Kaiser rolls was this endlessly marching. It was almost like a military parade of marching Kaiser rolls going to the stamp. Da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. So that was good. I mean, to experience an international bakery at the beginning of my baking life, I guess, must have made some kind of mark too.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, because so I'm 52. So when I was, in the late 70s there, you know, I'm around 12 years old, kind of a thing, 14 years old. And I don't have any memory at all of, you know, decent bread or that kind of a thing. And even when I'm reading books about that, it's like, those were the days of trying to make whole grain and making a lot of bricks and convincing yourself it was good, you know?
No, I'm sure that if we did have a listing of the bakeries in America at that time, she definitely would have been in the top tier. I'm sure there were pockets that had true ethnic bakeries that were doing a good job with bread or pastries or both, but it was pretty rare back then. Yeah. And so I think she really was right at the top in terms of what she was offering.
Yeah. No, that's so great that, you know, that you're able to stumble across that one day and then through a lot of persistence, boom, you know, change your life, basically.
It changed my life for sure. She had a massive impact on me because of her values, not just the products, but her values about baking.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you mean?
Really high standards. You know, sometimes it was not that welcome. I mean, if I made something in the bakery that she didn't like, literally it was being hurled at my head.
Wow.
And she had a good aim. So, I mean, that, you know, there's no call for that. It was a different century, literally, but still, that's a little bit much.
Really. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And so after the 5 years with her, what was next for you?
Well, then I got married and didn't want to stay in that area anymore because I figured I'd been there 10 years and I'd worn a pretty deep trough socially and all that stuff. So I should, you know, go someplace brand new with my new wife so we could start things together. So we moved to Martha's Vineyard and I worked at a very bad bakery there for 2 years and then just said, you know what, I want to start a bakery before I'm 33 years old. That was my goal.
Right.
So I was able to borrow $17,000 and I started a bakery that included the ingredients. It was pretty rinky-dink, for sure. I had baking skill by then, but I didn't have money.
Right.
And I definitely didn't have business sense. If I had business sense, I never would have done it, because I wanted to leave Martha's Vineyard and I wanted to raise my children in Vermont.
Right.
And the town that I wanted to raise them in was a town of 12,000. It had four functioning bakeries. It had been there a long time. And here I was coming along to start a bakery.
Right.
So I wanted to raise my kids there. That was my motive.
Yeah.
So I didn't have money. So we did everything. You know, we did the build out. I bought everything from auctions or junk heaps or whatever. And there wasn't a cash register, so the money went into a silverware tray. You know, no forks, it was ones, not spoons, but fives.
Yep.
Not knives, but tens, that sort of thing. There were two tables and three chairs, and so if a fourth person came along, this sounds crazy, but they'd get a 5-gallon bucket with a apron on top of it.
Yeah, that's their seat.
That was their seat.
Yeah.
Yep. I didn't have enough refrigeration, but I had opened up in December. And being in Vermont, it was cold. And so I had a dough sheeter. So I'd sheet out the patons of puff pastry into, you know, Napoleon sheets or whatever it was going to be, wrap them really tightly on sheet pans. And then I put them in the trunk of the car because it was a freezer.
Yeah.
So pretty rinky dink. Health department never said open up that trunk. But my philosophy was, even if I had access to a lot of money, I don't know that I would have wanted it, because I didn't want to be kind of psychologically tied down by the idea of monthly payments.
Sure. Yes.
I felt like, all right, I didn't have business skill. I mean, the sign for the bakery was cardboard, poster board from the art store with magic marker.
Yep.
You know, eventually we grew into things, but my philosophy was, okay, if the products are good, that will be your advertisement. And people are going to say, wow, I just had a really good piece of cake, instead of, wow, I was sitting on a bucket.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So it worked out fine. After I was there for just over 2 years, Susan, my first boss, decided she was closing her shop. And she offered to sell me everything that I had trained on.
Oh, wow.
And she waited until I found a bigger space in town. It was 100 yards away. And I bought everything I had trained on. So now I had a steam injected oven. I had a big walk-in. I had proper mixers. I had thousands of tart molds. I had her library of books. It was pretty fortunate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So that was, So I owned a bakery for 14 years, which was pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And especially, well, in a town that already had bakeries as well, you know, and so to get that established, that's a good thing.
Thanks to me. They all went out of business ultimately.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of them, there was one that was wholesale that I think didn't go out of business. The other three retail places did.
Yeah.
And I think it's because there weren't enough people to support what I was doing and what they were doing.
What they were doing. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I'm just thinking timing wise for that, would have been sort of through the 80s that you.
Bakery started on the anniversary of Mozart's death, December 5th in 1983.
Okay.
And in 1997, unexpectedly and unwillingly, I had to leave the bakery. Basically, it was one of those rather stupid things called a divorce that was ridiculous. So the bakery. But at that point, I had been at the Coupe du Monde in 96.
Yeah.
And after that, I had a call out of the blue from the guy who was the head of the baking and pastry staff at CIA, Marcus Fairbanger.
Okay.
And he asked me if I wanted to come down, have a tour, maybe talk to the graduating class of baking and pastry students, give a demo. I said, sure, I'd love to. I've never been there. So I went down and enjoyed it, and then was asked if I wanted to try out to see if I had enough skill to be part of the faculty. And I said, yeah, I'd love to know where I am relative to my peers. You know, I own a bakery in Vermont, so I'm never going to leave there. But yeah, I'd like to see if I had the goods to be on the faculty at CIA. So I went back down and took the 2 or 3 day practical, and did well enough that they offered me a job. And I said, well, that's great. Thank you. But you don't understand. I own a bakery in Vermont. That's where I'll be spending the rest of my life.
Right.
And then when I lost my bakery, I called CIA and they said, yeah, we'll hire you. So I went there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And after 2 years, I was really, really fortunate. It's a quite a palace, CIA. There were some things that were really odd that didn't really work well for me.
Right.
Not in terms of students at all. The students I adored, but more in terms of the administration was a little unexpected in a lot of ways for me. And I had some run-ins with them. I thought we were all there for the students, but it didn't really seem like that in everyday life. So anyway, long story short, I was coming through Vermont with my wife and we stopped at King Arthur to just take a break. We were going up to northern Vermont to see Helen and Jules Raben and stopped at King Arthur. And Brynna Sands, who was the wife of Frank Sands, they were the last owners of King Arthur before they made it employee-owned
in 1986.
Brynna saw me and she said, would you come back to Vermont and start a bakery and a teaching facility for King Arthur? And I said, oh my gosh, this is how I can get back to Vermont. I really, really longed to be back in Vermont. So I came in 90, that was in 97 when Brynna asked me. No, I'm so sorry. That was in 99.
Right.
I came to King Arthur in 1999 and started the bakery. There was nothing there. Brynna always, the company will never be complete just selling flour. It'll only be complete if it's also teaching and if it has a production bakery to show what the flour can do.
Sure.
He was the visionary. And so in 1999, I came back to Vermont.
Wow. Wow. Well, oh man. Well, I wanted to talk to you about, I wanted to learn more about the Coupe du Monde and your experience in 96. Just because if I understand my history right, that was sort of the first win for the U.S. Was that true?
U.S. was, the Coupe started in 92.
Okay.
By Christian Vabre. America was not part of it. In 94, America was invited to send a team. They had a stated goal of finishing in the top six. Back then, there were only nine countries.
Okay.
My computer is doing something here. And they did finish in the top six. Their work wouldn't be considered terribly skilled in this day and age, but they put a mark down and America got invited back for the 90s. Okay. The Coupe started in 92. 94, America had a team. 96, I was on the team.
Right.
And that was the year. The judging was different back then because they would have best bread, best viennoiserie, best artistic design, and best overall.
Okay.
Now they just do first, second, and third.
Right.
So that was the year America won best breads. I did the artistic design, which was won by the Japanese that year.
Oh, okay.
And rightfully so. Their work was breathtaking, actually.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's when the world was kind of shocked into what, America? Making really good bread
for
us? Yeah.
Yeah, because that's sort of how I've learned the story through the guild was that was a real turning point that says, hey, we might be in North America, might be, you know, on par or getting to the level of some of the other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get involved in that from your bakery in Vermont?
Well, the guild put out words. I was a member of the guild. I think, and I can't remember when the guild started, if it was 90.
I think it was 93.
Yeah. And I joined in 94. I went and checked out the Coupe that year. And then in 95, the guild was soliciting people to try out for the team. It wasn't like it is today. The guild didn't have any money.
Right.
It was located in Pittsburgh. And to try out for the team meant that you would send your work in. You had to, I think if I'm correct, you had to do work that was two out of the three categories.
Okay.
So that if you were good, but your bread wasn't as good as that guy's, that person would get the bread and maybe your artistic design would land you artistic design. So, and then you're instructed to put it on this flight on this airlines and the guild would pick it up at the airport and judge it.
Right.
So that's how I got on the team.
Oh, wow.
We had a total of two practices together. Huh. Unlike today, where it's once a month for 3 or 4 days.
Sure.
So it's a really, really different story back then. But yeah, the coop was a very, very good experience. I think the overwhelming thing that stayed with me at the coop was, you know, there were a lot of MOFs there, the Meilleurs Ouvriers de France.
Right.
These are the gods of the baking world or whatever. There's MOFs for electricians and plumbers too, but in whatever, if you're an MOF, that's as high as it gets.
And yeah.
There were a lot of them at the coop, and lots of them liked the microphone. The French do like to get up there and talk, and you'd see them up there talking and talking and talking. And there was a room in the back where competitors could go and chill out or talk to the media, or that's where we would eat. It was off limits to the public. And I remember I would be eating, and there was this MOF who was lean and looked like he had a lot of spring left in his life and just nice looking guy. And this man would be serving my food and cleaning my crumbs.
Wow.
He never looked for the mic. He stayed in the back.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was, you know, about up to his ankle bone in terms of my accomplishments in the world. And here's this MOF who brought this incredible level of humility to things. And I think that when I look back at the coop, that was the overwhelming thing that I carried. You know, there was a lot of camaraderie among the different teams. That was also wonderful. So, for example, the U.S. competed on day two that year. On day one, the Japanese competed, and we were in the bake shop that they had used for day one. So
right.
We overlapped with them. We were in there for our 1 hour of prep work while they were cleaning up.
Okay.
They made a point of coming over and saying, be careful tomorrow. The steam in the top deck is very weak. Make sure you steam it extra. It's really weak. Well, they wanted to win as much as anybody.
Sure.
But they felt like they had an almost moral responsibility to let us know to be on the lookout for the steam in deck number one. And that's the kind of spirit of the coop that I think it probably was the prevailing spirit. I think it changed over the years. It has certainly become much more competitive, almost more nationalistic in a way, I think. Not necessarily bad. I don't want to sound like I'm judging it. It's a little bit different from my personal values about things.
Right.
But back then, you know, we would, in the evenings, we'd go back from Villepinte where the exhibition hall is, and we'd all the competitors, all the teams would be on the same bus, and it would be dark. It was February, and everybody was tired. And you'd hear little knots of conversations in different languages from different parts of the bus. And maybe somebody would start singing a low song or something. And it was nice to be among all those languages and, you know, kind of going to and from the site with your co-competitors. And then we would have quasi-mandatory dinners together.
Right.
So I definitely remember leaving the restaurant the night before we were competing. I was standing on the Seine trying to get a taxi at midnight. My alarm was going off at 4 a.m. to get up and compete. Yep. So that was a good milestone being at the coop. Yeah.
Sure. Well, and that's that story, I think, really is a good example for me of sort of this perception that I have of you of being a real ambassador for bread and for baking. Whenever I see a story of you, it's well, I had these two bakers from France after Wheatstock up to my house and spent some time with them, and it warmed my heart when I read about that. And because I was at their lecture at Wheatstock, so I had this real image of who those two gentlemen were. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, oh yeah, they're hanging out at Jeffrey's house and we're going over here. And
That would have been Hubert Chiron, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then with the traveling you're doing these days and going around teaching, it's the togetherness and the connectedness between between bakers is I think something that that I really appreciate, but I also I sense that you do as well, because I see you as sort of, you know, one of the standard bearers of that, of you know, let's get together and let's compare and let's talk and and really
I get more attention than I probably deserve. I'm grateful for it, for sure. Right. But I definitely have gotten a lot of attention. But I really try to, it's important that we all understand that it's really the bread, the pastry, the baking that's important. It's not so much an individual person.
Yeah.
It's the baking. It's the bread. That's what I really like to impart to people. Just the beauty of baking, the dignity of being a baker. The camaraderie of being a baker, all the good parts about being a baker. If I can impart that to people, I feel really, really good.
Yeah. That's excellent. So you talked about the move to King Arthur. I'd love to learn a little bit more about that, because I've not been to Vermont in my life, but King Arthur Flour and that baking center that you helped start really, it's touched a lot of people over the years, and so I'm curious really about how you helped build that out and sort of what's it like there now, or what's it like while you were building it for
Well, it's a very, very beautiful, magnificent facility.
Yeah.
Just the whole structure. So there's a big retail store that sells most things you could need if you are baking at home. There's a big cafe. I think there's about 90 seats in it, but it's very tasteful. It's not just one big square room. It's corridors and little tables here and couches over there. It's quite comfortable. The 7-day-a-week production bakery. There's a big savory kitchen that's doing a lot of stuff. Then you've got the production bakery where there's windows. People can look in, and they do. Their faces are pressed against the glass all day long. And it's a wonder to watch. I mean, it's beautiful. The bakery has, fortunately, even though it's a good size, it's a big little bakery. It's big enough to, when I left about 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, there were 20 full-time bakers plus positions for 2 student externs from culinary schools. So it's big enough to give a livelihood to almost 2 dozen people. And yet, fortunately, it's still small enough so that everything is shaped by hand. Everything is loaded by hand. People rotate positions within the bakery itself. So it still has that feeling about it, which I think is really important. It keeps people really invested.
Right.
And the classrooms are remarkable. The instructors there are just really, really skilled. The evolution of the classes has been really, really great, because now the level of instructors is really high. So regardless of what's being taught, it's being taught by people that really know their stuff. And what's being taught also, the classroom is unique because they're not just teaching professional bakers. They're not just teaching home bakers. There'll be classes for kids going to a class with their father to make a Mother's Day dinner for their mom.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
There'll be kids camping this summer where they're doing different things for a week long class, or there'll be lots of guest instructors come along doing different things. There's a lot of savory classes. There's people really skilled in kind of Middle Eastern cooking. So there might be classes in all these wonderful flatbreads. There'll be classes in fresh pasta, you name it. They're all over the place. Yeah. And they bring in some really high level guest instructors too, which of course is a wonderful thing. So I definitely was not able to do anything other than get it off the ground. And then for 18 years, I taught the professional classes.
Right.
But the director of the school, Susan Miller, she's got a great vision and she has a great team. So it's a pretty smooth machine.
Yeah. Yeah, really, really seems like it. I remember I was at a guild class in Texas. Maybe 5 years ago, maybe. And there was someone there from King Arthur who I believe was working in marketing. She was like on the marketing side of things, but you know, was out taking the class and trying to get a better understanding of how it went, so she could take it. You know, she didn't work in marketing. She worked on customer support, was what it was.
Uh-huh.
One of the customer support people that would take the calls in, which was a remarkable thing to me when I learned about that, because you know, Robin Hood in Canada, you can't phone anybody and talk to them about their flour. Like it's
three or four or five people whose full-time work is answering the phone. And
yeah,
you know, if somebody said to me, you know, my bread didn't rise, what's wrong with it? I'd say, I don't know. Do you have a week or two? We can talk about this. But these people, this is their salary is doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, can you teach me a bit about, what it's like working for an employee or working in an employee owned company, because sure. I think that's pretty special as well.
It's unbelievably special. It's so special and so unique and so different that it took me 5 years to really get it.
Yeah.
I was there for just about 18 years, but the concept, you know, the concept of actually being an owner, it took a while for that. I guess it was osmosis before it really entered into my inner being.
Right.
It's really, truly extraordinary. It's not that there's no hierarchy. There is, but it's sort of a small H hierarchy. I mean, there's three people who are co-CEOs.
Right.
Right. And then below that, there's directors. So I was director of the bakery, and Susan Miller's director of the Baking Education Center, that sort of thing. And then below that, there's team leaders or shift leaders. So there is somewhat of a hierarchy in that sense, but it's a completely open book company. I mean, salaries aren't shared, but every other financial aspect of the company is shared. And when the company does well, everybody benefits.
Yeah.
You know, the bakery is profitable on its own, standing on its own. It doesn't get free flour. Some people must think it gets free flour. The bakery pays market price for flour. We buy it in from a distributor, like other bakeries would have to as well. But the benefits are extraordinary from the perspective of what most bakeries are willing or able to pay their staff. You know, you get 5 weeks vacation your first year.
Wow.
Incredible benefits. And it's truly a company where the values are not just something that are put out for marketing purposes. The values begin with those three top CEO types that I mentioned, and they percolate right through the organization. The number of things King Arthur does for which it gets no marketing value is unbelievable.
Yeah. I think
there's not even any hope of getting any selling any flour or making any money, but well, we're going to do this because it's the right thing to do. So I've spent part of my last 3 years at King Arthur working with a federal attorney to try to develop a certified baking program at a federal prison
okay.
in New York State. And there was never any chance or expectation that King Arthur was going to sell one bag of flour. But I had a complete green light to spend as much of my work life being paid by King Arthur to work on this project as I needed to. And wow. That typified the values driven.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. That's so excellent. I have this vision of just the way everyone's posture could change. Even if you're a production baker and you see something that's going on, it's just sort of like, hey, well, I've got a stake in this too. I've got a, mm-hmm. you know, I've got to mention or got to suggest it or, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of a thing. And, you know, when I had my bakery, you know, in the good times, it was like that, even though we were never set up that way as employee owned, but you know, in the bad times you could there was a wall. It would be, well, hey, it's your place. I guess if that's how you're going to do it.
And, right. Right.
And it's right. sort of like, well, that's not in the equation with you there. Yeah. No, that's awesome. I'm curious about the experience of writing your book, the bread book, which is the, that's just so you know, that I recommend that book to absolutely everybody whenever I'm giving my little library talks. Mm-hmm. That's always the book that I've got beside me because I recommend Lionel's book for the pictures, Lionel Vatnay's book, and yours for the content for sure, mm-hmm. And also for the stories because I've spent so much time even just reading the sidebars of that book more than anything. But I guess what you've done sort of a second edition now. But were you at King Arthur when that project was going on, or was at what time was that when you first wrote that?
I was introduced to the culinary editor of John Wiley and Sons at an IACP meeting in 2000, probably 2000, maybe 2001. And one thing led to the next, and I was asked if I wanted to write a sample chapter and this and that. So I guess I felt at the time that there weren't really any books on bread making that were written in English that were particularly notable. And the ones that were written in foreign languages, you know, the German books are very German-focused. The French books are very French-focused. They don't seem to cross outside of their national boundaries very often. And I thought, well, I've been baking at this point 25 years, and I had the good fortune of being an instructor at this point, 2 years at CIA and a couple of years at King Arthur at that point. So a lot of themes that seemed to trip students up frequently, I was aware of. And so that gave me some places I could really focus. And so I thought, well, if I can write a book that's better than anything out there, then that'll put a mark. It'll raise the bar.
Yeah.
And then that'll provide an opportunity for evolution. So after my book comes along, another book will surpass my book.
Yeah.
We'll be getting better. And then another book will surpass that book, and things will keep getting better. So that was a big motivator for me. And, you know, people say, how long did it take to write the book? And I say, well, 25 years and 2 years worth of Sundays.
Yeah, for sure.
And the company was very good to work for, John Wiley and Sons. I really, really respected the editor a lot. And she really was very clear that she wanted my voice to come through. And she allowed me everything I wanted as long as I stayed within the pagination maximums.
Right.
The only time she vetoed me was, it was, I think I had already submitted the manuscript and it was starting into the production phase. And I said to her, Pam, I think the book should be anonymous. And she thought I had gone around the bend. She said, what are you talking about? I said, well, it's not about a person. It's about a subject. It's about bread. So I think it should be anonymous. And she vetoed that.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, I have to thank her deeply for that because I've had the opportunity to, you know, be on an awful lot of different continents with my sourdough. Actually, sure. Six continents at this point, still waiting on Antarctica. Largely it's because of having written the book. So
sure.
There's a lot for me to be grateful for.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, and it's, but right at the very start of the book, there's a line that you wrote about how, you know, everything that you're presenting, that you're standing on the shoulders of giants. And, right. and that's something that I adopt, that I really took to heart when I read it. Whereas I'm not, I think it was because of that, you know, that was a big influencer for me to say, I'm never worried about sharing a formula or sharing that because it's I didn't invent anything. I took from someone else and I tweaked it a bit to fit my conditions or my situation. But you know, there's a lineage all the time, right? And you were
well put.
You know, you were very open about that, right on the first page of of the introduction, and it stuck with me to this day that's sort of the journey that we're on, and you know, you're documenting it like you said at a point in time. And the way that you did it was very helpful for a person like me, because when I got it, I'd been to SFBI and mm-hmm. I think I might have, Michelle's book had just come out, so I got that, and then I read yours, and it was just sort of like, okay, I got the sense that with even the way you laid out the formulas and that, it's like, okay, I'm with you at your bakery, at an actual bakery here, and this is, you know, this is how we've laid it out, and this is how we've done it, or mm-hmm. or that kind of a thing, and it really helped me. And then, you know, even the appendix on baker's percentages, or the appendix on starters and that kind of thing, is just, you know, it was that sort of put the mark down that, okay, here, you know, you can give that appendix to somebody and say, there you go, it's there for you, now you can work, you know, now you can move on from it, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier anecdotes and sidebars, and I think it's worth saying that, again, Wiley said, whatever you want to put in there, go for it. And to me, it was like, well, they're an important part of the baker's life too.
Sure.
If those weren't there, I think that would take a certain dimension away from the overall book, because then you're just left with a bunch of bread recipes, which is fine, but it can be a little bit dry.
Yeah.
So all bakers who stay with it long enough, they're going to have a whole bunch of recollections and anecdotes, and
it's
important for people to see that there's that part to a baker's life too. It's not just showing up to work and working like crazy and going home. There's the interaction with customers. There's all kinds of things that can be very, very moving in a baker's life.
Yeah, very, very much so. I think that's the in the conversations I have with guys that are just starting out or are starting small, and you know, when the talk always comes to money and cash flow at some point, and it's, which is important and is required, and yet there are a lot of intangibles to the mm-hmm. work that we do as well that need to be part of the equation.
That's right. You know? Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, like most bakers, for me, it's been the case that, you know, hundreds of people over the years have asked me or have said, you know, baking, oh my gosh, it must be so hard. Well, it's manual.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's hard. In fact, I think for me, the definition of hard would be if I'm, you know, if I had a job where I'm sitting down in front of a computer all week long, I think keep the windows locked tight, because I'd be jumping right out.
Yep, for sure.
You know, I feel like, in fact, if you are in a baking situation where it isn't just 5 or 6 shifts of repetition, the same work every shift, if you're really in the rounded fullness of a bakery job, then it's ideal in the sense that your mind is fully engaged, because, as you know, bakers are never doing one thing from A to Z and then starting the next thing A to Z. Bakers are doing 6 things at the same time. So your mind has to be completely fully engaged, and your body is too. And isn't this the perfect way for the human being to be?
Oh, yeah.
Involved and engaged in work? I would think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I just talked with a baker that that we used to work together, and she left the field for a while to take an office job, and lasted about 3 months.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, when I'm baking, I come home and I am tired. Like I'm physically tired and I'm mentally tired, but I made something today. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when I was working in the office, I would come home and I would be just completely exhausted, that I didn't want to do anything, but I never felt like I had accomplished anything.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And that, you know, and even if you're having a bad day or things don't turn out, you get that immediate chance to, well, we're going to get it again tomorrow, mm-hmm. you know, we'll get mm-hmm. to do it again, mm-hmm. you know, so, mm-hmm. you know, I was open 5 days. So long as we peaked on Saturday, we were good, you know, because if you had to wait till Monday to get at it again, that wasn't so. I'd like to get your opinion or your point of view on sort of the landscape for bakers today, as opposed to when you got started, you know, because you've got the context of getting started in the 70s, and you know, it's, you know, 21st century now, and there's how have things changed? How are, is there anything that I guess what's the best thing that's changed, and really if there's anything that kind of concerns you about where we're at now?
Well, that's a big question mark,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Sorry about that. Yeah. I should have broken it up.
Oh, let's see. Well, things have certainly changed without a doubt. I mean, maybe it's easier for people to start a bakery today because customers are more experienced with good baked goods.
Right.
But maybe it's harder for people to start a bakery today because if you don't have enough money, you certainly aren't going to build a business if people are sitting on 5-gallon buckets with an apron on top.
Yeah.
So those days are over.
Right.
I think is it more challenging to start a bakery today? I don't know the answer to that. You know, when I started, people weren't that sophisticated with their taste buds like they are now. But my bakery was successful, and I think it's partially because if the products are good, people are going to respond to that.
Sure.
You know, you're not going to get the whole market. You're not going to satisfy everybody because maybe your stuff's more expensive or whatever it might be. But if it's really good quality, you'd think that you're going to be able to have a clientele. So I think now, well, let's see. What are our challenges now? Probably what America does worst, it also does best. And what do I mean by that? We don't have this hundreds and hundreds of years old food traditions.
Right.
So things that we do worse would be things like every 5 years we need the next wacko diet
right
to come along that everybody is obsessed with. And then that'll get replaced by the next one. And this is not something that's so rampant in a lot of other countries because they do have a long food culture. That said, there's still a huge craze in France at the moment, for example, for gluten-free eating among celiacs. But we do a lot of that kind of stuff, which is too bad. But what we also do best is something that other countries don't seem to be able to do too easily or successfully, and that would be to look outside our own borders at other countries. So as I said earlier, the French are not looking at the Germans and saying, oh my gosh, I want to learn how to make 3-stage 90% rye.
Right.
And the Germans aren't saying, gee, I want to learn how to make fill in the blanks. We American bakers, and by the way, when I talk about America, Canada is part of North America.
No, I understand. Absolutely.
America means the continent.
Yep. Yep, for sure.
A single country. But we American bakers, we do have the cultural liberty to look outside our borders and to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're doing this in France. I can't believe they're doing this in Germany or Spain or Italy or wherever. And then to adapt it and learn it and revel in that. So we're very, very fortunate in that regard. I guess if there's anything that is a little concerning to me, it's that it's not uncommon to find bakeries where things are a little bit too precious. I have no personal grudge or argument with ancient grains, for example, but I know that for the most part, they yield very low compared to wheat, wheat.
Yeah.
And if there's any member of society more important than a baker, that would be a farmer.
Right.
And I don't endorse the idea of doing things that don't have a direct positive impact on a farmer's livelihood. So what would induce a farmer to grow, for example, emmer or einkorn? The only inducement would be that he could get more money for the crop, because if it's going to yield sometimes 10% of what wheat does, well, the diesel for the tractor is going to be the same if it's 10% of the harvest yield. The time spent is going to be the same. So if your yield is that low, the only way you can make a go of it is by charging more. That's understandable. That's economics. But then the next result of that is that the baker is making bread that has to cost a lot more
yeah.
to the consumer. Yeah. And then that perpetuates something that I really don't like, and that is that people that are reasonably well-to-do or well-to-do are the ones who can afford that bread.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I didn't know anything about flour for an awful long time. And I'm not exaggerating or being falsely humble when I say that. I didn't know anything about flour. So all the years I owned my bakery, my philosophy was buy the cheapest flour you can, because that way you can sell your bread for the lowest possible price. Okay, I was still using a natural sourdough that was fed every day and right, making very good breads, but the flour I was using wasn't particularly good. I don't think I bought bleached flour, but it wasn't good flour. But my feeling was, no, the bread should be as available as possible. So again, I never went to business school. So for me, I would rather sell 200 loaves of bread for $3 a loaf and gross $600 rather than sell 100 loaves of bread for $6 and right, gross $600, right? I wanted to have the bread as accessible and available to as many possible people as I could.
Yeah.
Well, I would hope that knowing more about flour, I could still be able to do something like that and try to really keep the prices low. The fact that I started and have always, all my life, been very deeply involved in pastry production and things like that, it was clear early on that, yes, you can keep the price of your bread reasonable so as many people as possible can buy it, and you can have that fancy cake subsidize the bread.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the beauty of a bakery that's more of a full service type bakery.
Sure.
Right? Because what's discretionary? Bread should not be a discretionary product. And yeah, it is all too often. Good bread is too often a discretionary product. Yeah. Cake is a discretionary product.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. No, that's really nice. And, you know, one of the things I've always admired, you know, reading when you're posting on the Guild site or whatever, is that the breadth what all this new stuff brings you, it doesn't narrow it down, you know. And you've posted a few times over the years that, hey, like I'm going to enjoy a lovely white baguette today and a whole grain rye tomorrow and so on and so forth. And so it's always been a, you know, an expansive view, not a narrowing view. And mm-hmm, you know, I'm going to do this with sourdough, and I'm going to do this with yeast, and I'm going to mm-hmm do this with you know, with butter, right? And
that's right.
That's all, yeah, that's and that's really helped me. You know, it's helped me out a lot in sort of not feeling like I'm doing it wrong mm-hmm if I'm making this loaf. You know,
and, sure. If it's made yeah with good ingredients and good respect, yeah, for ingredients and good technique, then yeah, then fine. It's great. So let's have the biggest proverbial breadbasket that we can instead of restricting. So I don't feel like white flour is evil or dead, which you read frequently these days.
Yeah.
I don't think yeast is necessarily bad. Abuse of yeast, too much yeast. Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Just using yeast, I don't feel like I'm Darth Vader or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that's been really heartening to me when you're wondering about, you know, my sense of the current baking scene, this is more than just North America now, but because of having written that bread book, I've had a lot of opportunities to bake in different countries, and it's really cool to see countries that are now where the US and Canada were 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So I just returned a week or so ago, I guess it's almost 2 weeks now, from a second trip to Russia.
No, cool. Yeah.
Classes, and the devotion is really high among the bakers, devotion to bread and the real curiosity and drive to learn to bake better. And if you think of a flower, you've got a shoot and then you've got a bud and then you've got a flower. And America is definitely in the flower stage right now.
Yep.
Russia's in the bud stage. And I remember seeing that in Korea some years ago when I taught there. They were in the bud stage, and now that bud is opened into a flower. And when I see these really avid Russians who are just dying to bake, boy, it does the heart good. You know, it really makes you feel like you're part of a global community.
Yeah. Well, and that's an awesome story for me to hear. My heritage is Eastern European,
you know,
a little further south, but more from Romania, what's modern day Romania.
Hmm.
But, you know, it's sort of like, excuse me, when you hear about, well, that's grain country, you know, for Eastern Europe and especially like Ukraine and that kind of thing. That's grain country. And I live in grain country, and it's so nice to hear about, you know, hey, it's still an important, it's an important thing and becoming, you know, even more, more interest and more variety. That's warms my heart for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey. You know, you're a very humble person, but I gotta say that, you know, I can't think of anything that I've done in the last 10 years that hasn't in some way been touched by you and your writing or my perception of you, put it that way. It's just I'm making hot cross buns in a couple weeks for Easter. And I, you know, it's the dirtiest page in your book is the hot cross bun recipe book. And, you know, when we wanted to make, soda bread for St. Patrick's Day at Orange Boot, it was like, okay, you know, that was the start. Okay. So here's the recipe. Okay. What are we going to do with this? But it was always the starting point. Just let's see what Jeffrey has to say on that. And even this idea of, you know, here's a guy that, you know, you competed in the Coupe du Monde and, you know, you can wear the big hat and the chef coat and stuff, but my image of you and when I've seen you work and that is, no, you've got the short cap, you got the pencil up the side, and you know, you got a white t-shirt and you're making the good stuff, right? And you know, even you know, I have to give you props for the pretzels that we sold at Orange Boot Bakery became edible, I will say, after my wife took your class at Wheatstock in 2012. And we, you know, when she dragged me over from the class I was taking and we looked at even just how to set up the dipping station and that kind of thing, I said, oh yeah, that's a lot easier than how we're doing it. And those kind of things. And so it's just, you've really, you know, you've touched my life in a very positive way over the years, even though we've only, you know, passed in the hallway a couple of times. And so I just wanted to thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Mark, for that. You know, I'm just trying to pass it on, you know?
Yeah. No, and that's what
the last thing in the world I want to have is secrets.
Yeah.
And share.
For sure. And like I said before, that's been a big inspiration for me to share everything that I'm learning almost as I'm learning it, which is a lot of what this podcast is turning into in a way is, learning something from the people that I'm talking to. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I'm thrilled that you're on the show and that we get to share this conversation with people.
Well, thanks for asking me on. I appreciate that.
And there you go. That's Jeffrey Hamelman. What a great guy. It was a beautiful visit. I was so glad to get the chance to talk with him. Just hearing his stories about going to Russia and going around the world teaching his classes and just hanging out with other bakers feels so, so good to hear stories like that. I can just imagine the fun and the challenge and the learning. So we are doing good work. Let me put it that way. We are doing good work when we are baking. And you are doing good work when you are baking. And that's I think, all you can ask for. And like you said, it's manual work. It's physical work. It's a mental challenge. But isn't that what life's all about, eh? And when you can do that kind of work and make people happy, that's a good place to be. And so thanks for that, Jeffrey. I really appreciate it. And I hope that that's the spirit that I can capture on every podcast with all the people that I talk to, because like he said, there's a huge network of bakers out there that are doing the good work. And it's sort of my desire, my goal, my dream to talk to as many of them as possible and to share those chats with you. So I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you're making the good stuff this week. Have a great week. We'll be back with another show next week that's going to be another one that's a little bit different, but I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. Thanks for sharing this with all your friends. And until we talk again, happy baking.